This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 9955 kilohertz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kilohertz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio. Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette McQuarrie and Keith Perron.
Hello and welcome to the monthly edition of Media Network Plus. It's nice to have you with us. Coming up today, Indonesia has been modernizing over the last 20 years, and many democratic reforms have also taken place at the same time. But one area that seems to be moving at a slower pace is freedom of the press, as self-censorship has been on the rise. During the Cold War, Radio Berlin International, along with Radio Moscow, Radio Kiev, and others, was one of the most listened to stations. Just like the wall coming down in 1989, Radio Berlin also vanished into history. Or did it? Well, it seems Radio Berlin International is coming back. This is Media Network Plus, stretching your mind. Ah, we already know some of you have brains like rubber. Oh, Keith. Here's Keith now with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
During the Second World War, Switzerland's fledgling shortwave radio service was essential to its attempts to communicate its policies and actions to an external audience, made up of both foreign governments and the Swiss abroad. The archives of the shortwave service, founded in 1935, have been digitized and are now available online at Swiss Info.
I am perfectly convinced that someday will come when the turmoil of war will cease and peace will be restored. But when? Day and night this burning question tortures the mind of every man and every woman in Poland. Each time they look with distress at their pale and starving children, they are desperately asking themselves, how long will the frail bodies resist? Is there any help coming?
The Swiss shortwave service was the forerunner to Swiss Radio International, which later became Swiss Info. The manuscripts of news bulletins from that dark time in Europe reveal Swiss thinking on events both out of its control and right on its doorstep as the country desperately held on to its beloved neutrality. The SWS broadcasts news and analysis of military events on both sides. Broadcasts by SWS at the time were notable for the fact that they were both the first news bulletins produced by a dedicated Swiss editorial team. Previously, news bulletins had been written and read by journalists from the Swiss News Agency, a press organization. Representatives of the Voice of America and Radio Free Asia insist their goal is to only educate North Koreans about the reality of what is going on in their country and around the world. We're not interested in promoting the overthrow of the regime in North Korea, said Lee Dong-hyuk, the chief of the Voice of America's Korean service. We're not engaged in any form of political goals or objectives. We provide information, he said. A better informed citizen can make informed decisions about their fate, whatever direction they might want to go. Max Kwok, Radio Free Asia's Korean service director, echoed that position, adding, "The value of what we offer to the people of North Korea depends on its objectivity, accuracy, and reliability. We believe our listeners in North Korea want the truth." Kwok and Lee looked forward to a day when their jobs will become obsolete, but they said don't expect on that anytime soon. The English language Russia Today last week tweeted that its hosting provider had confirmed that RT.com was under a DDoS attack. An anti-WikiLeaks group subsequently claimed responsibility, but there was yet no proof of this connection. This also happened on the day when a Russian court decided the fate of three members of a punk protest band Pussy Riot, which have been very critical of Russian President Vladimir Putin. RT's tweet came through at 8:12 a.m. Around 20 minutes later, AntiLeaks tweeted that it was responsible for the DDoS attack and attached a hashtag supporting Pussy Riot. The WikiLeaks account then went on to condemn the attack, suggesting that it was a connection with RT's support of Assange rather than the punk band. And with that look at some of the headlines from the world of media, we end this bulletin. If you wish to find out more about these and other stories, we invite you to check out the blog from Kim Andrew Elliott. You can find a link for them at www.pcjmedia.com. At the bottom of our page, you'll see an icon for Kim Andrew Elliott. I'm Keith Parron.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio. A new investigation into the Indonesian media suggests that even in an era of democracy, press freedom is still far from guaranteed. Dr. Ross Tapsell, who lectures in Asian Studies at the Australia National University, has published a paper called Old Tricks in a New Era, in which he argues self-censorship is still alive and well among Indonesian journalists. Radio Australia's Richard Ewart speaks to Dr. Tapsell and former Indonesian journalist An Suryana.
Ross, perhaps if I can start with you. You're saying that self-censorship is still alive and well in the Indonesian media, particularly in the press. How would you characterise that self-censorship at the moment?
Yes, so my research comes from interviews with a lot of journalists over a six-month period in Indonesia last year. And from what the journalists told me, the greatest concern over their autonomy was that of ownership and media ownership. And other studies have supported this claim, saying that the biggest influence over what Indonesian journalists can write and what they cannot is actually that of ownership. So this is all important, I guess, for looking at how do we frame freedom of the press in Indonesia.
So, Arne, is that a model that you would recognise in your experience, particularly at the Jakarta Post?
Yeah, basically when I was working for the Jakarta Post as a journalist, we are socialised that as a journalist, we have a freedom of expressions, but we have also have responsibility. I mean, when we write a piece of articles, and then we also need to take into considerations regarding the impact of our writings. That's at times spark self-censorship among our journalists. But we need also to understand that actually the ideals or the visions of newspapers or media outlets also shape self-censorship among journalists themselves. So basically, the journalists, they will tend to follow the visions and missions of the news outlets they are working for.
So did you, when you were writing as a journalist for the Jakarta Post, did you feel comfortable with that? Did you feel it was the right thing to do?
I was very lucky because actually the Jakarta Post has the same vision and mission with me. I mean, I always respect meritocracy. I respect democracy and pluralism. So I'm happy to do it. But for some people who are having a different background with me, perhaps they are coming from hardline religious background, for example. So perhaps they are not happy in doing it.
So if I could bring Ross back in at this point, I mean, based on what Arne has had to say there, I mean, does self-censorship necessarily mean that the truth is not coming out, if you like. Perhaps it's just a more guarded way of getting news out there in a country where there are certain sensitivities to be considered.
Yes, so I think the key factor in the self-censorship is what drives it. And if what drives it is a kind of media ethics, then that's very much understandable. In this new argument that I've put in Old Tricks in a New Era, I'm arguing that we're seeing an increasing trend of prominent politicians and businessmen in Indonesia who are owning media companies and forming alliances. And so now, 10 years on after kind of the initial explosion of print media outlets, we now have 12 media groups controlling nearly all of the Indonesian media. And that includes a lot of online news media, which is important to state. A lot of people think, oh, well, we've got the internet, therefore, there's great freedom of expression there. So these controls, I suppose, or these conglomeration of media owners, therefore means that there's more likelihood that self-censorship is going to be driven as a practice in journalism by the ideals of the media owners. Aan is lucky in the Jakarta Post in that they don't have an overarching media owner. But in other companies, they can be owned by prominent politicians, including owners, including political party leaders, or businessmen.
So have you come across examples where journalists have been pressured by media owners to... So in other words, it's not self-censorship, that they've actually been told to change their articles?
Yes, there are a number of examples where you could really look into the details of how... I mean, it's not as if a journalist would be told directly, rung up by, a prominent Indonesian politician. Journalists don't work with owners in a direct sense. But it's more how the system operates. And what happens often, and in one case in Surabaya, when the newspaper was taken over by Golkar chairman Abu Rizal Bakri, we saw that the Surabaya Post, the newspaper there, couldn't write openly about the mud flow which was occurring on the outskirts of Surabaya, because Bakri also was involved in the Lapindo Bakri Brothers group, which was involved in that mud flow. So that's just one specific example where if the politician... takes over the newspaper, or a prominent politician owns the newspaper, that would automatically affect how journalists feel that they can write on certain issues which affect that owner.
I mean, you've risen up the ranks at the Jakarta Post. You've held a managerial role there as well. You've heard Ross suggest perhaps that life is a little different at the Jakarta Post to maybe some other Indonesian publications. But how much influence can you, in a managerial role, bring to bear on the owners of the Jakarta Post? Do you have a good relationship with them?
So basically, we are very lucky because the Jakarta Post consists of different owners. I mean, there is no majority of owners in our newspaper. So, and then also the owners... they also came from a journalism background. So basically they understand that it is very important for the owners not to interfere into journalism practices, because if the owners, they interfere too much to journalism practices, and then people will be going to lose their faith to the newspaper. Like, for example, if the newspaper owner, they ship very much... the publications of certain articles, and then people are going to lose trust regarding the newspaper, and then certainly that the newspaper will go bankrupt if they fail to win the trust of the people.
So do you see your role at the Jakarta Post and that of your colleagues on the newspaper as filling the gaps, as it were? I mean, you heard Ross there talk about the example of the mud flow and what could and couldn't be said in certain publications. Presumably in the Jakarta Post that wasn't a problem for you.
There is no problem for us, because we are guaranteed by the laws and regulations in Indonesia, and Indonesia is now a free country.
Now, Ross, I'm interested in what the dangers are of failing to self-censor. I mean, if a journalist, as it were, defies not a direct decision, because as you pointed out, there's maybe not a direct connection between the owners of publications and the journalists themselves. But if a journalist is sitting there thinking, well, if I write this and it goes to press, I'm taking a risk, I mean, what can happen to them?
Yes, there are a number of examples of journalists having been moved from certain desks, and this doesn't just occur, I suppose, because of influence on media owners, but we've seen this throughout Asia. If a journalist writes something that, say, the government cracks down on in other countries, that might be the case. But where journalists have moved from, say, the political desk to suddenly be covering sports or fashion, or alternatively, they move to the night editor shift. That's a common kind of you're in the bad seat if you move to, you know, the 5 a.m. shift as an, or 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. or something as an editor. But there are a lot of examples where journalists would tell me that they would write stories and they would just look at the newspaper the next day and it would be changed. And they would explain that the real story didn't come out because editors were tentative to really comment openly about the business interests or political interests of the owner in a negative or controversial light. So we did have many cases of journalists who would quit their publication and say, I don't want to write under these conditions. But of course, you know, they've still got to find another job. And as I said, there's really 12 media groups that are owning and controlling the Indonesian media. So it's difficult to then say, well, I'm going to work for another news agency.
On that point, Arne, I mean, do you consider that there are enough journalists in Indonesia who would be brave enough to take the system on, as it were? Or, as Ross rightly points out, do they have to look after their own interests and make sure they stay in work?
I think so far, like, the power of owners are very huge. So in other publications, people will be reluctant to take risks because it is a concern with their life and also their family living as well. So basically, the influence of capital here is quite huge in the Indonesian publications. Yeah. Because people, they don't consider regarding themselves, but they have to take into account as well the living of their family.
And in terms of the way the press as a whole operates, do you consider that the press in Indonesia is in a reasonably healthy state, even allowing for this undercurrent of self-censorship?
Yeah, so the recent press freedom rankings of Freedom House, Freedom of the Press, has Indonesia ranked 97th out of 197 countries. Now, that's the 2012 rankings. Now, that's actually better than it has been for the past 10 years. Indonesia is usually ranked in about the hundreds, 140, I think, is out of 190 is as bad as the rankings have been. So over that past 10 years. So it does make you question, I suppose, you know, how free is this press? I mean, the Freedom House rankings, of course, are always somewhat problematic. In that, you know, rankings are naturally, you know, problematic in that way. But it does throw into caution the idea of the complete free press that occurs in Indonesia as after democracy, which did occur, particularly after 1998, when there were 1,200 new print media and more than 900 new commercial media licenses awarded in a 4-year period after Reformasi. And now we've seen that increasing conglomerisation of the Indian and cartelisation, I guess, as one Indonesian observer has called it. So the recent title of that Freedom House report was that the party's over for openness and that more restrictions are expected of the Indonesian press and Indonesian media. So, you know, we're watching closely and hoping that that's not the case.
Arne, I mean, what do you think it will take to change the situation, to make it easier for journalists to essentially write what they want to write?
The health of the media operation is very important. And if the company is healthy, and then perhaps the company and also journalists, they can look forward to improve the independence of the media. But the problem is, like in other parts of Indonesia, and the media companies, they rely on advertising. They have to struggle to survive. Then when it comes into that problem, the media independence is at risk.
Can I suggest to you, Ross, that whilst the focus here, obviously, and on your work is on Indonesia, perhaps there is an assumption that this kind of self-censorship going on in the media only happens in a country like Indonesia. It couldn't possibly happen in a country like Australia. But isn't the reality that perhaps the media ownership means that Australia is moving towards the situation in Indonesia?
Oh, exactly, a very good point. And certainly media ownership and the consequences of it are not limited to Indonesia, both in Asia and in Australia, of course, with the issues of the Murdoch press and recently Gina Rinehart. And the role of, I guess, mining magnates now involved in the media in Australia is actually quite similar when you look at someone, say, like Abdurizal Bakri, who has interest in mining and a lot of other things. Being involved in the media. But certainly it's not just Indonesia, in Asia as well. I mean, the South Korea, research done in South Korea found that most journalists surveyed nominated media owners as the determinant most likely to influence press freedom. And certainly India has a newspapers that are largely owned by business barons. Certainly don't want to suggest that this is limited to Indonesia, but this is an increasing trend. And it is interesting to think about, I guess, more broadly, is, you know, who's going to afford to own newspapers in the future with the declining circulation and, as Anne suggested, the health of or financial health of print media generally. So we kind of must wonder or ponder that in the future, perhaps the only people who can really afford to own newspapers are going to be those with vested interests or those with who make money out of something else and then are using the media to further their interests. Perhaps that is the future of the print media in the Asia Pacific.
So with the internet and news coverage on the internet growing ever larger, presumably that the role, particularly, for example, of the bloggers becomes ever more important, because you would assume that in most, if not all, cases, they will write what they want to write and nobody's going to stop them. And that's the way of perhaps plugging the gap that exists in the Indonesian press.
Really interesting point. The future of this is certainly not clear. I think it's important to include online media in some of this media ownership. For example, in Indonesia, Charul Tanjung, the owner of Trans TV and Trans Tujuh television stations, bought an online news media, Detik.com, for $66 million Australian dollars. Detik.com is currently Indonesia's biggest online media site. So certainly we are seeing an increase into online news. And if you would talk to any of these media owners or media executives, they would say the future is with online news. And if you were just to scan news websites of either television news or newspaper websites, you would find that there's an increasing trend to try and link social media into these websites. And what we're seeing is a convergence of platforms. And so this does raise the question, though, does that give bloggers more autonomy or more ability to get their voice out in the mainstream media because it is now linked to mainstream media? Or does this mean that owners are trying and you know, media corporations are trying more thoroughly to incorporate these bloggers and these social media outlets into their message, and therefore there'll be less room for social media and independent bloggers to get their message out because they'll be all consumed by this media convergence? Really interesting to look at in the next few years.
Okay, final point to Arne, if I may. I mean, you began your career as a journalist back in November 1998, I believe, with a Perspective.
Yep.
So
yep.
What are we now? I'm doing the quick maths here. 25 years nearly down the track. I mean, do you think that the press is better now, that it's freer now than it was when you started, or is it just different?
I think the press is more free right now, but the problem is still with the media ownership and also the healthy operations of the media. For example, the newspaper is still very influential in shaping public policy, but the problem with the newspaper right now is that we earn so little money from advertising. We have to migrate to online because this is the future of our newspaper publications. But the problem is when you are migrating into online, you are going to earn little money. While right now, the bulk of the money is mostly coming from print advertising. So basically, this is a big problem right now in Indonesia because the circulation of newspaper is stagnant.
Dr. Ross Tapsell and former Indonesian journalist Ann Suryana speaking with Radio Australia's Richard Ewart.
Call the PCJ answer line at country code 44-20-3286-1399. That's country code 44-20-3286-1399 and leave your comments and questions. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
A few weeks ago, Victor Gunatelica joined us for a review of the new DRM receiver, the DR-111. Both Keith and Victor were less than impressed by its performance. Well, Neustar Electronics, who make the radio, have just come out with a new software for the radio. Is there any difference? Well, let's see.
As you can tell right now, I've sort of stepped away from the studio for a little bit. There is a reason for that, because right now I have two receivers in front of me. The DR-111 DRM receiver and a Sanjin ATS-909X. Why are we doing this? Well, as you may know, a few weeks ago, we did a review of the radio, the DRM radio, that is. And you can say we were, well, less than impressed. At the beginning of August, Neustar Electronics came out with a new software for the radio, claiming that it would make a big difference. While it's true, some things did change, what about the overall reception? Well, let me give you an idea of what it's like. So, like I said, I have two receivers. And for both of them, I'm going to use the same antenna, the Deegan 31MS active antenna. The station that we're going to tune to is Radio Australia on 21725 kHz. Now first, let me turn on the Neustar DR-111 receiver. Okay, so here it is.
And we hope that what we've put forward here is productive in that sense.
You've constructed a series of shorter and longer-term measures.
Actually, I have to say, not bad. Mind you, this is a very clear signal for this time of day in this part of East Asia. So let's now disconnect the antenna from the DR-111 and plug it into the ATS-909X from Sanjin. And what do we get?
In the region instead of coming to Australia.
I think the way you've suggested it is the way we would like to go, to have
Now, the signal meter on both of them is quite interesting. On the Sanjin radio, I'm getting, a plus 5 signal. On the DR-111, the signal's around 1 and 2 and keeps cutting in and out. So yes, while it's true the DR-111 is picking up a decent signal, but the audio quality is just terrible. And I think a lot of that has to do with the small speakers that are inside of it. Let me plug it back in, and here we go, and turn the volume up. It takes a while.
And with our comprehensive package and the vision that's embedded within the work that we've done, we think it's the way to go.
So reception is a bit of a problem with this radio. Now, the other night I tried to listen to the Sinhala service from All India Radio. I used the IF out on my Texan radio and had no problem picking up a signal. On the DR-111, all I got was text. Well, to find out a little bit more about what this new software is all about and did it really make any difference, we're now joined on the line with Victor Gunatelica in Sri Lanka. Victor, let me ask you, at the beginning of this month, Neustar Electronics came out with a new software to install into the radio. It was very easy. You go to download it from the website, put it on an SD card, put the SD card into the 111, then plug it in, and then it automatically will load the software. Now, let me ask you, since you've did this a few days ago, did you see any major improvements in first, let's not talk about the performance of the radio, but the way the radio operated.
Well, to start up, yes. Updating that, putting the SD card, that was very quite simple. I think anybody will be able to do it today. Okay, that's one. Second, did it improve the performance or the way it works? Well, one of the major things that they intended was to undo the muting on the AM tuning. I think last time we were talking about how to get an AM station or tuning round. You had to push the tuning button in, and then you start tuning around. The frequencies start moving, but nothing comes in because the whole set is muted there.
Right.
And then you stop up at a frequency and push the button back again, and then the station comes up. So now that has been dealt with, so that as you tune around, you hear the stations moving. So I think that's very nice, and they should have thought that long ago, but great.
You know, you're absolutely right, Victor. That is actually a big improvement, especially, I mean, in this part of the world, a station like Channel Africa is difficult to pick up even at the best of times. But I managed to do it by accident, only because the audio was still there when I pushed the button in for tuning. So, yes, that was an improvement. What about other things? Did you notice any other changes?
Well, the first thing I noticed after installing the updates is that the receiver noise level, the internal noise level, was noticeably higher than before. So I was not quite happy with that. And okay, but besides that, the tuning round, that's very useful. As you say, you hear the station, and that's a great improvement. But one more thing, I just don't like the tuning knob and the volume controller to be on the same tuning knob. Because as you tune around, some stations come crashing in, and you want to run just the volume down, and that's not possible. So one thing I like is, if they did what they did now, if they can have an independent volume controller, I think that'll be a tremendous improvement. Besides that, I didn't notice any improvement in the sensitivity. So all the updates, what I got was that on AM, not on DRM, on AM, you don't have the muting, so it's much easier and it's more comfortable to tune around, as you also pointed out, Keith.
Now, what about this? This was something that somebody mentioned to me a few days ago. Do you think it would be a good idea on this radio to have an RF gain?
Well, what I want is to have sideband as well on this radio if possible, because even the cheapest Chinese portables now have SSB. And in that case, of course, an RF gain control would be quite an essential thing. But leaving aside a single sideband tuning, on the RF gain, I don't really know whether it's going to be of much use, because the sensitivity, there isn't a huge signal that comes in that you have to grab the RF gain control to cut down or things like that, because this is very simple. And I don't think that is an issue for me, but I would like the volume controller to be independent of the tuning.
Now, you are in Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka has a very different power grid that we do here in Taiwan. Now, here in Taiwan, Victor, something that I've noticed with the receiver is the receiver picks up a lot of noise from the power supply because of the kind of power grid that we have. What about where you are?
Well, yes, it does pick up quite a lot of electrical noise and from the power supply. And frankly, I haven't changed the power supply to something like a battery, a car battery that gives me 12 volts. So I haven't done that. So I really can't. I shouldn't be commenting on that, Keith. But it does pick up quite a lot of electrical noise.
Okay, Victor, final thoughts. Final thoughts for the 111. I'm sure that down the road in the future, we might discuss it again if they listen to this. I mean, you know, somebody said to me it was kind of strange that we came on, we complained about the tuning thing, and all of a sudden, literally 2 weeks later, it was fixed. So I do have a feeling that they are finally kind of paying attention. But your final thoughts.
Yes, before I get to my final thought, Keith, if you don't mind, I'd like to comment that the light on the tuning window should be kept on, or at least a switch there. Because on DRM mode, we have constantly text moving. And on this window, the DR111 knocks the light off after about a minute, and you can't read anything. You have to juggle with the tuning knob a little bit, and then the light comes on. So things like that, small practical improvements have to get on. And my thoughts are still, I don't think I'm prepared to pay $150 for a DRM receiver with all these bugs. But having said that, I'll tell you, Keith, I've compared the receiver with my Perseus and the external antenna, and I'm quite willing to say that DR111 DRM reception is quite satisfactory. But, of course, the dropouts are there. So as a standalone, with few bugs, it's still good, but not up to the mark as we expect it right now as it is.
Last week you were talking about the return of a radio station called Radio Berlin International, now talking about a trip down memory lane. And it seems that this strange story just keeps getting stranger. What's going on with it?
Well, to give you a little background in case somebody is not familiar with Radio Berlin International, Radio Berlin International was the voice of the German Democratic Republic, also known as East Germany. Now, West Germany had Deutsche Welle, and Communist Germany had Radio Berlin International. And what happened was, a few weeks ago, one of our listeners posted something up on the PCJ Facebook page. And it was shocking to me because it said, Radio Berlin International has come back. And I went, wait a second, was I sleeping and all of a sudden East Germany reformed again? I mean, it was just the strangest thing.
No kidding.
Now, Radio Berlin International signed off in 1990. Now, many people may know the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, and it was almost a year after the Berlin Wall came down that many government institutions in East Germany continued until they can find a way that they could join their West German counterparts to become one organization. Radio Berlin International was one of those. After the station signed off, quite a few of the staff ended up at Deutsche Welle. A lot of others took early retirement, and some of them lost their jobs as well. Now, not too long ago, I had listened, because I hadn't listened to it in a very long time, the last broadcast that Radio Berlin International put out in English. And before they continued with the rest of their program, right after the news, the head of the English service made sort of an odd editorial.
My name is Robin Mitchell, head of the English section, and I'm here to host this final program from the German Democratic Republic for you. At midnight tonight, my country, the German Democratic Republic, will cease to exist. Earlier this year, the two leading Christian Democrats of the two Germanies said, no one will be worse off than before, once Germany is united. Well, I would like to point out two errors. One is that there are already more than 2 million people in this country who are out of a job and far worse off than before. And the second error is that there is no unification of two Germanies, but rather an annexation of the leftovers of 40 years of so-called socialism by the Big Brother. And that is exactly what has happened between Deutsche Welle of Cologne and Radio Berlin International. After much sweet talk about a fusion and merger on an equal footing, what is happening is that Radio Berlin International will disappear tonight, and that Deutsche Welle will have taken over our frequencies and our transmitters tomorrow. Out of a total staff of 250 RBI employees, a mere handful might get a new job with Deutsche Welle. Thus, like for so many in this country, unification days spelled unemployment for many of my colleagues. The champagne of jubilation has a very bitter taste to it.
Anyway, Paulette, that was kind of an editorial from the head of the English service at Radio Berlin International when they signed off.
Now, talk about just picking up one of the words that they used, definitely bitter.
Yes. Now, I myself was a listener of Radio Berlin International. But getting back to this odd story, there's a Facebook page out there, there's a YouTube channel, there's a Twitter account, and so many other places where this organization called Radio Berlin International has been posting stuff like crazy. Old pictures, old QSL cards, and, you know, they're planning to come back and everything. But yet at the same time, they're not giving too many details. It would be like, for example, Paulette, I know that you have Ukrainian background, and it would be like all of a sudden one day you get a letter from the Ukraine saying, oh yes, Radio Kiev is coming back.
Yeah.
you know what I mean?
That was my thought when you told me about this. I thought, how strange is that? It's like, is somebody stepping back into a time capsule and nobody else is joining them? Like, this is just so strange. So you said that there was a Facebook page. So did you get a hold of anybody whoever's behind this resurrection of Radio Berlin International from communist days?
Well, I posted a number of questions on their Facebook page and also messaged them privately, which is questions, basic questions like, what is your content going to be? And every single time I would get back a standard reply that didn't respond to any questions. And then what happened was I remembered an email that I'd received maybe just over a week ago, and I dug it up, and there was a phone number of somebody by the name of Bruno Barth. So I decided to call him up, and this is what he said at the beginning.
The program we will do is not political. We have parts of industrial teams. We have parts of cultural work, youth work, education work. We will promote new technologies in radio technologies. We will promote new technologies of energy and so on. Not political, and all these things from the history of GDR is not interesting for us, and is also not interesting for the listeners. We have in the last weeks many feedback from international listeners, and they are interesting not for political things. And RBI should be a voice, an international voice, that all interesting technology parts or energy things can make public.
So I hope that he isn't the one that's going to be behind the mic.
It was almost as if they didn't have an idea of how to respond.
Well, yeah, that was what I got, Keith, and that is very reminiscent. I visited the old Soviet Union back in 1983 or 84, and that just is very, very, sounds familiar. I felt like I was stepping back in time when I was listening to this guy.
Well, you know, one question, and I think this is a viable question, is, you know, where's the money going to come from? Because the East German government is no longer around. The Germans already have Deutsche Welle, which the German government funds. So what about RBI? So I asked the question, you know, where is RBI going to get its funding? And this is how he responded. Now, I should tell you that this clip is a little bit longer.
The money is only privately. Mm-hmm. The people we have phoned RBI in this year. We have created an association, and this association, the name is Center of Radio and Energy Technologies Nauen. And we give our privately money in this association, and in step two, we can have money from the government, or we can, we will be donate from privately organizations or from other privately people.
Okay, now here's something I'm really curious about. I mean, this is something when I started reading the information that people sent me, right, is why call it Radio Berlin International?
Yes, we call because we will get the information, the first information that in the transmitter station, in the big historical transmitter station, known as trade association. That's the main information, and we have think the best is that we get the old radio name RBI to the antenna and say worldwide, hey, here is a new association, and the main focus is that we will protect the historical transmitter station known, and on the second we will do working for research and working for technical education. We have an interesting situation that the most of the listeners of RBI are not interested for political, they are more interesting for technical things and for educational, cultural things, and the part of political is from 100%, perhaps 10 or 15%, and the people are not interesting for political things. The most people are interesting for cultural, technical, education, and other things. And I was grow up in the GDR, in the east side, and a part in the west side. My family is coming from the west side and from the east side. And I was growing up on two sides. And I can say to you, the Federal Republic of Germany, the GDR and the BRD and so on, the two states, no one of these two states is okay. The DDR is not okay and the BRD is not okay. All two states have problems.
What struck me about these clips with Bruno is just he kept going round and round in circles and saying the most ridiculous thing. For one thing, you know, his English is not very good, so I don't imagine he would be the one behind the microphone if they did decide to go ahead with this. But it's very, very curious. He keeps talking about, nobody's interested in politics. They're going to stay away from politics. But politics is what it was all about, for one thing. And for another, politics is really the hottest topic now in the broadcasting business. If you look down south to the United States, it is the political talk shows and blogs that draw the most traffic. This is what people are most interested in. And he's saying that, oh no, there's this nostalgia for the past, but not the politics. And that just doesn't make really any sense. This guy must be living in a dream world. Are you sure he's not delusional? Is there anything in your exploration of this story that indicated that this really was real, or is this just somebody with access to technology that's living in a dream world?
After I did this, I thought, you know what? I should have a friend of mine who's actually a freelance journalist also contact him and see if he could ask the same questions and see if the answers are the same. And I sent my friend the exact same questions. And I said, ask these questions and then we'll compare notes. And you know what? Yes, it was the same outline. Basically, it was talking with not really saying anything. Now, this is where the story even becomes funnier. About an hour after all this happened, and my friend talked to him and asked him some questions, they posted on their Facebook page, thanks to, I'm not going to mention his name on the air, but thanks to so-and-so, and they posted a picture. Now, I've known my friend for more than 15 years, and that was not his picture. So I posted on their RBI comments area, who is this? And they put, oh, this is Mr. So-and-so. And I went, oh, this is too funny. So I called my friend again. I said, I know we haven't seen each other for a couple of years because we live in different parts of the world, but did you go in for any plastic surgery? Basically, what they did is they, because he has a Chinese sounding name, they just went to the internet, maybe Googled the name, put Chinese, and just took a picture of anybody off the internet and put it there. So he laughed and he thought this was too funny. So he had their email because they sent him some information. Now I should tell you, he asked for the information in English. They sent it to him in German.
Okay.
So he wrote back and he said, "Look, I don't think this is very professional to put a picture. I mean, this is not me. This is not my picture. How dare you do this? What do you say to this?" Well, about 12 hours later, he got a response. "Thank you for writing us. Oh, it's really nice to hear from you. And I hope that you will continue listening to us."
Okay.
And that was it.
No acknowledgement, no apology.
Nothing. Now,
wow.
This is where. Now, do you think it could get any funnier, Paulette?
Okay, that's a leading question. So my answer and what I really think are two different things.
Well, here's the kicker. I after all this happened, I went back on Facebook and I couldn't access their site. I couldn't access the RBI Facebook page. Now, first I thought that, oh, they took it down. Now, just before we recorded this segment, what I did is I also have another Facebook page, which I use my Chinese name for my Chinese friends who don't speak English, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I logged in with my Chinese name, and I was able to access it. So what they did is they banned me from their Facebook page because I was asking questions and I put them in an embarrassing situation.
You know, Keith, this really puts me in mind, as you know, I was recently in Ukraine, and I was in the western city of Lviv, and the driver and our interpreter driver was, for some reason, I ended up just with the two of us in the car, and he was pointing out some landmarks in Lviv, and one of them, he said, "You see that tall building over there?" And I says, "Yeah." And he said, "That's the tax department." I said, "Oh, well, very interesting." And he said, "It used to be the Communist Party headquarters." And I said, "Oh, now that's interesting. What has changed? Anything changed much?" And he says, "Yeah, the sign." So everything else stayed the same. The job descriptions, the duties, the staff, everything, they just changed. The business as usual. And they just changed the sign for optics. And so they're not fooling anybody. The other thing he was saying is that the President Yanukovych is putting up these ridiculous propaganda signs saying the age of the ruin is over and prosperity has arrived in Ukraine. And of course, he would put this right in front of some very dilapidated building or vehicle or just the worst parts of town. And people are just laughing. And, you know, people see through this, but they're carrying on like, talk about in a dream world. They're living in the past. This story reminds me so much of that. And I'm just wondering, is this just somebody really, on a nostalgia kick?
Well, you know, Paulette, because we're running out of time, but, you know, one of the things that I discovered when I checked their Blogspot page that they have, they have pictures of antennas claiming to be the antennas that they're going to use and everything, and this is a picture from the transmitter site. And I looked at them and I went, well, something strikes me as odd, and I realized the pictures were taken from a sales brochure from a French company called Thales that made these beautiful rotating antennas.
From a brochure
that they, I mean, it's amazing, you know, I mean, we could actually go into a whole other topic here about, you know, on the internet, you know, anything can be created. And I mean, this whole thing is just so strange and so peculiar that I thought, you know, we have to talk about it for one show. I didn't think we would do it so soon because I talked about it last week, but it just became stranger and stranger. And you know, Paulette, before we end off, I know that there's two people right now who would love this kind of story, and that is Andy Sennett, who had the Media Network blog at Radio Netherlands and also did stuff on the Media Network program when it was on Radio Netherlands, and also Jonathan Marks. I think the two of them would get a kick out of this story for sure.
Well, I think a lot of people will get a kick out of the story. Now, what can we expect with propagation over the next 7 days? Here's our propagation editor, Dan Hensley.
On August 25th, the 10.7 centimeter flux is 120, jumping 10 points to become 130 on August 26th. The 10.7 centimeter flux will jump up 5 points from August 27th to August 29th to become 135 during those 3 days. On August 30th and 31st, the 10.7 centimeter flux drops 5 points to 130 on those last 2 days of the week. The A-index will be 8 on August 25th and 26th. The rest of the week from August 27th to August 31st will see an A-index of 5. The KP-index will be 3 on the first 2 days of the week. That's August 25th and 26th. The rest of the week from August 27th to August 31st, we will see a KP-index of 2. We see some sunspots this week. They are 15, 46, 48, 51, and 52. No risk of strong flares has been observed as of this time. As of the time of this report, the sun's X-ray output has nearly flatlined and solar activity is low. One coronal hole has been observed, and a stream of solar wind flowing from the indicated coronal hole should reach Earth on August 26th or 27th. August 25th and 26th mean a little more D-layer absorption with the A-index being high, and the rest of the week, with the A-index being only mid-range high, propagation could be in the hit or miss category, depending on where you live or unless the A-index changes to a range between 0 and no higher than 3.
Thanks, Dan. And with that, we must leave you now. If you'd like to listen to this program again or catch past editions of the show, just visit www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus. If you have any story ideas and suggestions, or if you want to just share your thoughts about the program, please send us an email. Our address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. So, on behalf of Dan Hensley and Keith Perron, I'm Paulette McQuarrie, hoping you'll join us again next month for the 55-minute edition of Media Network Plus. To end our show this month, we're going to leave you with some East German marching music. Auf Wiedersehen.